This broadcast of Irish Radio Hour from Glucksman Ireland House NYU is paid for by Flannelly Promotions. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flannelly. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week. This weekend is a holiday, the first one, I suppose, of 2021. I'm referring to Martin Luther King Jr., the day of observance and commemoration and remembrance that takes place on Monday. And I was thinking about how we would pay tribute in some way to this important date in the annual calendar. It got me thinking about an interview I had the pleasure to undertake a couple of years ago with David Margalik, who is a very established and talented writer and editor, and Bud Mishkin, well-known media personality and interviewer and host. The topic of our conversation was David's book called The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy. It's a really interesting interview to hear David unpick the intersections and evolution of the context in which these very impactful historical figures, in particular Martin Luther King Jr., and of course, from an Irish-American perspective, the Kennedy angle is really interesting for us. So I'm delving into the archives this week to share that interview. As I said, I'm in conversation with David Margalik, author of The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, along with Bud Mishkin. So I'll hand over, folks, for the next 50 minutes or so. It's a really, really, really interesting chat, and you know, one of those ones where I go back into it, I remember and relive how interesting it was, which I had kind of forgotten over time. So enjoy, folks.
So these are two figures about whom more than a little bit has been written. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. What type of pressure for a writer does that create when you are writing about a subject and people who have been written about extensively?
Well, every writer wants to have something original to say, and it was very intimidating in a way for a couple of reasons. One was, as you say, Bud, and I want to thank you for doing this today. I mean, I feel the same way about you, and there are very few people around, actually, whose minds are so eclectic as to take in the varying stuff that I've done and sort of get it all. So I just want to say how much I appreciate you and what you're doing and your participation in this. I'm very flattered. And that's to say nothing of your inviting me, Miriam, and coming here. This is a different kind of group and a different sort of angle, and it's always fun to explore one's work from different vantage points. I want to thank you for that. So it's intimidating to come into something that's been so extensively written about. Even to come up to square one is hard because there are mammoth books on these guys. The Arthur Schlesinger biography of Robert Kennedy is over 1,000 pages long. I don't know about you, but it takes me a while to read a book that long. I mean, that's a lot of hours, you know.
Let alone months.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they add up to months. So that's the first thing that's intimidating. The second thing is that the exigencies of the journalism business these days, I got this thing as an assignment, and I was told I had 4 months to do it. So that made it even more daunting, really, in a way. It turns out that there was a third problem, which in some ways took care of some of the earlier ones. It was complicated because it turned out that for everything that had been written about these two guys, there was very little about the relationship between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And so that meant that I had kind of clear sailing on the one hand, but that there wasn't a lot of secondary stuff that I could look at and sort of rip off if I wanted to. You know, I mean, a lot of people who write books just sort of repackage other books. That wouldn't have been what I wanted to do anyway, but I didn't even have that option. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to. I mean, I had an excuse because time was so short. The idea was that this thing was going to come out in time for the anniversaries of the two assassinations. And so we were talking about this in April of 2017, and the thing had to be done. You know, you think with computerization and everything that things get quicker in publishing, but they don't. The lead time is the same, and you had to get it done by the fall of 2017 in order for it to be out by April of 2018. So that was 4 months, for 4 or 5 months. Originally, you can let me know when I'm going on too long here, but there's a whole history to this thing, which I think is kind of interesting. It was to me. I mean, this was originally going to be principally a picture book, done by the National Geographic. And I was, as I sort of say in the book, I was hired to do the grouting. You know, the pictures were the tiles, and I was just doing the cementing around them, and that was going to be it. But again, I really wanted to say something more important than that. We all want our books to last, and we want them, if they're not necessarily read at the time they come out, and that's often the case, you want them to be read somewhere down the line. I have a button somewhere that says posthumous success. You know, that's okay with me. You know, that's okay with me.
But no time soon.
Yeah, that's all right. No time soon, but that's okay with me. I was talking to a group of my father's old colleagues, doctors, the other night, and I said, it's a posthumous success. May not be so hot for you, but for me, you know, I don't mind it.
There's a great old Richard Thompson song called Now That I Am Dead.
Yeah.
And the whole notion is now Rolling Stone wants to interview him. Were you confident throughout the process that, understanding that no one had written about the connection between them, that you really had something here? Or are there moments of doubt of clearly they're two compelling people, clearly it's a compelling time. Is there really that connection there, or am I trying to create a connection?
Well, there was one sobering moment that I recount in the introduction to the book where I interviewed Robert Kennedy's eldest daughter, mm-hmm. Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. Some of you will know she was, I think, the lieutenant governor of Maryland, ran for governor or senator of Maryland, and a very formidable woman. And I interviewed her right at the beginning of my research, and she said, "You don't have a book here. There's no book here." Now that can generate a little bit of hesitation. That was not one of my more confident moments. And why did she say that? She said that because she said these two guys barely knew one another. There's very little correspondence between the two of them. She didn't say this, but it's true that there aren't even any good pictures of the two of them together. I mean, that's quite striking. I mean, there are some group pictures where the two of them appear together. But she said that, you know, the fact that they coexisted for a certain length of time doesn't mean that there's a book here. And she sort of sent me on my way. I suppose that had there been a nadir of my confidence, it would have been at that moment. But in fact, to answer your question, Bud, I never really doubted that there was a book. You know, we find, well, I knew I'd find a book.
Right.
I knew that I'd create a book. Now, the question, I suppose, is whether or not the book would be hype,
right,
in a way, or exaggerated to suit my contractual obligations. But my feeling was that you have the most important civil rights leader of his era and the Attorney General of the United States who determined the course of civil rights in this country. They had to be acutely aware of what one another was doing, and even if they weren't interacting directly all that much, they were very mindful of each other, and that in and of itself was a book. It just meant that it would be a little bit harder to ferret out the details. I also knew, very shortly into the thing, that Robert Kennedy started out in almost a negative position on civil rights. And Robert Kennedy didn't know Martin Luther King, and to the degree that he knew him, he was sort of hostile to him. And Robert Kennedy approved wiretaps of King's phone, and then a few years later, really in a blink of an eye, Robert Kennedy was eulogizing Martin Luther King more memorably than anybody at Martin Luther King's funeral. So how, you know, when you figure all the points at which they do come together, and the dramatic change in those moments from Robert Kennedy as hostile, really, to civil rights, to Robert Kennedy identifying with King, and conversely, Martin Luther King cursing Robert Kennedy's appointment as Attorney General, thinking that Robert Kennedy was a malign and negative force, and he tells Harry Belafonte, it's recounted in the book, you know, find me this guy's moral center. We got to deal with this guy. We have to live with this guy. You know, finding the good side of him, okay, and moving from that to the point where only 8 years later, on the eve of his assassination, he's prepared to endorse Robert Kennedy for president. So there's a dramatic evolution in both of their thinking about one another, and I knew that simply that thread, just piecing, just connecting the dots in that line was a book. So I was never really fearful of it.
And I think, David, that's really one of the major contributions of this book in terms of contextualizing that the evolving nature of the relationship and what's going on with them to see it culminating in the way that it did. One of the things that I wanted to ask you a little bit about from a historian's point of view in terms of sources, David, I think it was actually maybe in an earlier event you did with what you talked about the dominance, say, for example, of the New York Times as a source and how, you know, sometimes we don't actually think consciously enough, I think, of how much of a prisoner we are to sources in terms of what's dominating the narrative at any point in time. Can you talk a little bit about that in the context of the research first?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's an interesting point, Miriam, to me, because I spent 15 years at the New York Times, and I'm very loyal to it, and I love it, and I think it's more indispensable than ever. But that said, the Times has a stranglehold on American history in a way, at least among unimaginative or lazy historians, because the Times is readily available, the Times is indexed, the Times is usually clipped, the Times morgue is better than any other existing newspaper morgue in the country, the Times is on ProQuest, the Times is easily searched, and because of the Times's preeminence, people think that it's the only source or the best source for any kind of historical research. And I know that's not true. And not only that, but because it's the most deeply mined source for somebody, again, as I say, who was trying to be original, I knew that any originality I brought to this thing would not be from finding things in the Times that no one had seen, because it had been pretty weird. I mean, I did find things in the Times that no one had seen. Often, you know, little tiny things. I should be able to think of something, but little things about King or Kennedy, in what they call in the business shirt tails, little tiny stories at the bottom of longer stories that you wouldn't necessarily see. So there were original things even there. But, I mean, what I and some of the more senior people in this audience will remember, first of all, the Herald Tribune was a very important paper, okay? the Herald Tribune of blessed memory, mm-hmm. often better written than the Times. It was the writer's paper. I mean, people actually, when I was doing the boxing book, I came across a sports writer who left the Times to go to the Tribune mm-hmm. because the Tribune let you spread your wings.
Right.
And, you know, you're looking for sort of literate and colorful people to read, and you didn't find them in the Times. The Times was very dull. The Times is much more lively now, but it was dull back then. So the Tribune was out there. More important than the Tribune was the Post. I mean, you were talking before, Bud, about Jimmy Breslin. Jimmy Breslin was writing for the Post. Pete Hamill was writing for the Post. Murray Kempton was writing for the Post. Jimmy Wexler was writing for the Post. These were all people who covered civil rights and Bobby Kennedy closely.
To be clear, the New York Post.
The New York Post, yes.
It's been a much different New York Post.
The Dorothy Schiff New York Post, the pre-Murdoch Post. That's right. Which was absolutely a crucial source and is not scanned, so it's very hard to search. The archive of clippings has been sort of disassembled. My friend at the Post, at the New York Post, Eric Fetman, who's sort of the archivist of these kinds of things, got me into them to look at the old clippings there. But it's very hard to piece them together because there's no electronic way to do it. But it's very important to read all of these people. Then there's the Washington Post. Then there are the black newspapers. You know, the black papers were still important back then. The black weeklies like the Amsterdam News, Ebony Magazine. These were all very important. Just to go back to the Post, I meant to note that we're talking about Robert Kennedy here, but the New York Post was the first paper in New York to have a full-time black reporter. All right. So the New York Post was in Montgomery covering the bus boycott. In the 50s, 1954, 55, they had somebody down there interviewing Martin Luther King as the young preacher of the church down there, long before the New York Times was covering it. So these are all essential sources and ways of breaking out of the kind of stranglehold that my alma mater has over coverage of all of these things.
I love the point about finding something that you've been looking for, or finding something that, again, is perhaps not part of what the stories that most of us know. There's a great part in the book. Obviously, we know that death hangs in the air throughout the entire book, because we know what's going to happen at the end. And there's a beautiful piece of writing here, which I just wanted to say, on page 52, in which you write, later on, and especially after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, it became commonplace to say that both King and Bobby Kennedy knew they were doomed. Kennedy was no stranger to premature death, even before his brother's murder. By age 18, he'd lost an older brother and a sister, but only for a few years did death stalk him. It loomed over Kennedy far longer, it loomed over King far longer, so long that he had a chance to devise and polish what he said about it. Quote, "So I'm not afraid of anybody this morning," he said. "If I had to die tomorrow morning, I would die happy because I've been to the mountaintop and I've seen the promised land," end quote. It sounds like April 1968 in Memphis. In fact, it was January 1957 in Montgomery.
Yeah, the giveaway is there when he said this morning.
Right.
Because it was, you know, it wasn't in that famous last speech that he gave at the temple that night.
And yeah, when I read that, I swear, I read that like three or four times. That is one of those moments in a book that, wow, that is a great nugget. That is a great piece. Can you talk a little bit more about the writer as detective? When you know that there are things that are out there, a picture or a story, and can I get it? Can I verify it?
Well, and also, I mean, can you find things that are sort of counterintuitive, or change the story, or modify the story, or shake up the complacency of your readers or settled views of history? Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the story is that Martin Luther King had this prophetic moment the night before he was shot. I've been and I see, I may not get there with you. you know, and that everything had sort of crystallized for him that night. And, you know, and as that passage points out, he'd been saying these things, I mean, for better or for worse, he'd been saying these things for a very long time. I mean, I have to say that one of the pleasures that I took from doing this book was to shake things up. And if there was ever anything in there that sort of challenged settled views of these guys, I was happy to put it in there, even if it was disconcerting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, part of my job in doing this book, I thought, was to disconcert, you know. So part of that, I mean, it, with respect to Robert Kennedy, was to depict how right-wing he was before he became a moderate on civil rights. You know, there's a whole section in here, it's sort of apropos speaking here today, you know, where Robert Kennedy is asked by Anthony Lewis of the New York Times, and he gives an oral history shortly after. The Kennedys are very good about recording history. They're not always good about sharing history that they record. I mean, for instance, you still can't see Jacqueline Kennedy's oral history at the Kennedy Library. If you're Caroline Kennedy, you can see it and make a book out of it, but the rest of us can't see it. And all of Bobby Kennedy's oral history are various 8 or 9 volumes that he gave, I think, in late 1964. Most of it is available, but there are still lots and lots of redacted sections of it that you can petition to see, your petitions are almost uniformly denied. I don't think they opened up anything. These things were closed in the 60s, and they've never been opened. All right, so they're very selective about parceling these things out. But anyway, sometimes there are revealing things in there that even the people who are the censors don't see, you know, and that if you read them closely, you find these things. One of them was when Anthony Lewis of the Times, again, sort of the stranglehold of the Times, Anthony Lewis and Robert Kennedy were very close, I mean, almost alarmingly close by the standards of contemporary journalism. And, you know, you see, you know, when Anthony Lewis writing stories about Robert Kennedy saying, well, sources close to the Attorney General say such and so, and you know the two of them were just sitting and talking, and Robert Kennedy said, don't quote me on that, and so Anthony Lewis didn't quote him on it. But anyway, Anthony Lewis is interviewing Kennedy for the oral history, and he says, when did you first become aware of the problem of civil rights? You know, thinking that he's going to get, you know, the Kennedys with their famous dinner table conversations about politics and everything, surely the issue of Negroes and the Negro problem would have come up with old man Kennedy quizzing his kids around the table. And Bobby Kennedy says very proudly, we never talked about it. It just never came up. And he said, you know, he says in so many words, we were colorblind in our house. We didn't see the world this way. You know, some white people, it was the Depression, some white people had problems, some black people had problems, everybody had problems. We didn't see things. He was trying to frustrate Anthony Lewis's assumption about him that he was a liberal guy, and Robert Kennedy was very insistent that he was not liberal, and he didn't believe in special breaks for anyone. And I don't remember how I got off on that tangent.
But can I ask you something related to that a little bit, David? So do you think, in retrospect, because I, you know, fundamentally, my reading of this book, and why I think genuinely I feel like it's important for students of American history to read, you're plotting out the evolution of a black man's experience in America and a white man's experience in America, and how they evolve over time, right? So one of the things I was thinking about it in that context was, do you think that Robert Kennedy, were they so locked up in this idea of them as Irish Catholics and trying to, you know, or blend in terms of acceptance, that in any way framed how they saw race? If you know what I mean, I'm not putting that question very clearly. How did his sense of Irishness or his sense of being a Catholic feed into how he saw race, do you think, on balance?
Well, that's a tough question. I think that, at least initially, and maybe even going forward, Robert Kennedy thought of himself as sort of an embattled Irish American whose interest, who didn't feel a natural affinity for large questions concerning the civil rights of other people. I think that the Kennedys were sort of tribal, and when you follow Robert Kennedy, particularly in the 1950s, race is almost non-existent. He doesn't talk about it. I think his only interest was getting his brother elected president. And it just never comes up. In a way, it comes up in an interesting sort of microcosmic way that I think that I describe in the book and that I'm happy to talk about here. And he complicates, I think it never came up. And I think that because of his own peculiar psychological makeup, he wanted to resist people's stereotypes about him and depict himself as a tough guy and not a softy and not a sentimentalist. And so Robert Kennedy puts out a lot of disinformation about himself that makes it harder even to write about him, because Robert Kennedy was very determined. He wasn't going to satisfy Anthony Lewis by saying, yes, I just had this shocking realization of the great injustice inflicted upon black people. He was going to say, everybody had it rough and we didn't believe in giving favors to anybody. And that was very much his orientation. This was why Martin Luther King was so upset when Bobby Kennedy was appointed Attorney General. Again, this is not part of, King is frozen in 1963 in this country. He's frozen at the moment that he gives the Eye of a Dream speech, and he's, sort of acceptable to everyone now in retrospect. And we don't deal with King, the late Martin Luther King, who was a radical figure and a divisive figure in really challenging the American economic system, challenging the war in Vietnam. I mean, why was it that there were no pictures of the Kennedys with Martin Luther King? It was because Martin Luther King was radioactive to them, and they didn't want to be seen with him, okay? Which makes the endings, the place where these two guys ended that much more striking. Robert Kennedy is sort of frozen now in 1968 in Indianapolis when he's giving this speech about brotherhood on the night that Martin Luther King is killed. But why was it that Martin Luther King was so upset when Robert Kennedy, the president's kid brother, was named Attorney General? Robert Kennedy had worked for Joe McCarthy. Now, we all know that he works, and this is something that I learned in doing the book. I mean, I guess I should have been able to figure it out, but it's something that I hadn't thought through, and I had to learn this. I'll speak for myself. I, as a white liberal guy, have my own issues with Joe McCarthy, and he was a villain in my home, all right, for all the usual civil libertarian concerns. But in black America, there was an additional dimension to the antipathy to Joe McCarthy, which was that many black leaders had been leftists or even communists. Like Du Bois was a communist late in his life. Harry Belafonte was a lefty. The Daily Worker called for the integration of baseball long before any other white paper did. All right, so, I mean, communism and radicalism were not the malign forces in the black world that they were in the white world, particularly among the black leadership. So in aligning himself with Joe McCarthy, Robert Kennedy was sort of, McCarthyism was code for racism among the black leadership. All right. So that was another reason to be skeptical of Robert Kennedy. And John Kennedy in 1956, when John Kennedy was running for vice president, he was running against Kefauver, who was considered a Southern progressive. John Kennedy was the favorite of Southern racists. So Robert Kennedy goes to Little Rock in 1956, and he says, "We Kennedys sing Dixie around our breakfast table every morning." So this was the tradition that Robert Kennedy grew out of and came into. And this is what Black America knew about Robert Kennedy when he was named Attorney General, which is why Martin Luther King was so horrified by it and said to Harry Belafonte and the other people in his inner circle, you know, find me something good about this guy because we have to work with him.
And yet this is the same guy who late in the book, there's a great Bobby Kennedy quote about black radicals that, you know, after what they've been through, we need to listen to them. Paraphrase.
Yeah.
What was the scene for that?
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, Robert Kennedy is such an interesting figure because he's unpredictable in a lot of ways. He was rebellious. And I think Robert Kennedy, in some ways, Martin Luther King seemed dull to Robert Kennedy. He was sort of a stuffy religious guy. Of course, that was the only side of King that King would show Kennedy. I mean, the sort of ribald King, you know, the sort of jokester, the very funny guy that his colleagues knew, was not somebody who could ever be shown outside black circles. And so, you know, I guess Kennedy couldn't be blamed for thinking of King as sort of a dull and stuffy religious guy. But Robert Kennedy liked the presence. He wanted to meet people who challenged him and confronted him and would teach him things that he hadn't seen. This was the reason why this meeting has been discussed a lot, but my book has the fullest discussion of Robert Kennedy's meeting with James Baldwin in 1963. When Robert Kennedy invites Baldwin to meet with him and round up a bunch of people to meet with him in New York at his father's apartment on Central Park South, and Baldwin shows up, and Belafonte is there, and Leo Horn is there, and Lorraine Hansberry is there, and all of these black intellectuals are there. And they really give Kennedy a rough going over. Kennedy is very upset about this. I mean, the thing turns into a Donnybrook. Kennedy expects all of these people to thank him for everything he's doing as Attorney General to assist the civil rights movement. And they all feel that the Kennedys are dragging their feet, and they start dumping on him. And it's a very dramatic scene. And Kennedy is apoplectic afterwards and denigrates all of the people that were invited there and finds disparaging things to say about them, finds homophobic things to say about James Baldwin, says who are these people, you know, and who are they? Half of them are married to whites anyway. I mean, he's very angry about the whole thing afterwards. But it's significant that Robert Kennedy called the meeting to begin with. Robert Kennedy invited all of these guys. You know, he put himself in the line of fire, more than John Kennedy ever did. Robert Kennedy was curious and wanted to learn. These were not the radicals that you were referring to, Bud, but you're talking about meetings, including the night in Indianapolis, the night that he gives the speech, where he wants to meet people off the street, and he wants to meet people who are sort of more plugged into the community, not these highfalutin people in suits and ties, but the street guys and the guys in the African clothes and the guys with the afros. And these are the people that he wants to meet. I mean, there's one story in the book where he's meeting with Bud Schulberg, the American writer and screenwriter, organizes a writer's workshop in Watts after the riots. And Robert Kennedy is invited to speak there. And Robert Kennedy says, "Don't bring me any Uncle Toms. I mean, I want to meet people who really represent the community." And that was, you know, that's the other side of him. And it makes him such an intriguing guy to write about, that he really wanted to learn. And he wanted to be challenged. I think it's another theme that runs through his life, that he was kind of a macho guy. You know, I mean, the conventional explanation is he was the runt of the litter and he was the smallest of the Kennedys. And so that's why, you know, that's why he played on a broken leg and got his Harvard football letter, which Jack and Joe never got. You know, always trying to one-up his older brothers. This is why he was whitewater rafting and climbing mountains and all of this. And part of that macho thing was taking on unruly people and finding out what they had to say. And that's, as I say, it's one of the reasons that it's fun to write about him, because he's always sort of surprising you and shaking things up and making you realize, you know, his own complexity.
You don't, you know, Martin Luther King, as you mentioned, and is brought out as a theme in the book, David kind of knew he was on borrowed time to some extent in terms of how long he would be around, perhaps. You don't think that Kennedy, at one point in the book you kind of talk about how he didn't think that bad luck could happen again, if you know.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. One of the other things that you do when you're writing a book like this on in a limited time, and where an awful lot of the material has been reviewed already, you have to find eyewitnesses, and you have to ask them questions that they haven't been asked before, or you have to find people who haven't been interviewed before, you know, people beyond the usual suspects. The usual suspects here are, you know, people like Andrew Young, John Lewis, anybody who knew both of these guys or one of these guys, Marion Wright Edelman, Peter Edelman,
Belafonte.
There are, you know, the universe of them is small. You know, when I was talking to these medical people the other night, I said, we're all in the same business. We're all in the triage business. You know, I have to get to these people before they die. And that's what this was really almost in the nick of time that this was done. And that's true for the Burns book, you know, that you're reading now, Miriam. I mean, it was the last chance to find anybody who knew, you know, we're rescuing history. And one of the people, there was one interview that I had with Harry Benson, the photographer. You know, Harry Benson has had this glorious career as a photographer and photographed the Beatles in their pillow fight. I mean, again, Glenn knows more about all these things than I do. He's probably had a program with Harry Benson, right?
It's extremely important to know who photographed the pillow fight.
Yeah, and you do know that.
This is important too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you do know that. Anyway, Harry Benson photographed both King and Kennedy, and he described the difference between their behavior in crowds. And he talked about how Robert Kennedy was sort of heedless of the threats around him, that he just plunged in and he had sort of, his fatalism was not in, you know, he knew that he was targeted, but he wasn't going to let it stop him. And he was going to plunge in and fate be damned. He was just, you know, he resented restrictions on his actions. He told his minimal security people not to resort to sort of evasive tactics, not to unload the car in the garage, to park on the street even though there were crowds outside the car. His security guy, whom I tried to interview, his chief, the guy that was with him the night in Los Angeles, just died the other day. I never could get him to talk to me, but now his oral history will be available to read now that he's no longer around. Bill Barry. Anyway, this is Harry Benson describing Robert Kennedy's kind of, Robert Kennedy was a free man, and he wasn't gonna let fate or danger inhibit him. It's the flip side of, again, the whitewater rafting and climbing Mount Kennedy and all of that. He was not going to be stopped. King had a very different response. Harry Benson was saying that when King was in a crowd, he was looking around everywhere. He was acutely aware of the threat that could be behind from any window or you know, any elevated position. And they got him out of there as quickly as possible. I think that if I'm not mistaken, Benson photographed the march from Selma to Montgomery, or one of those epic civil rights events, and he described King's feeling of menace as opposed to Kennedy's feeling of liberation. So they both felt that there was a gun, that there was a bullet with their names on them, but they had fundamentally different responses to it.
Can I ask you, David, sorry, but I know I want you to jump back in, but you know, the Irish are big into funerals, and we there's a lot of emphasis put on funeral traditions and stuff in the Irish context. And in that vein, I don't think you made it into the book. I think you wrote about it in some pieces afterwards. Kennedy stepped in with pragmatic support for Martin Luther King's funeral. And can you talk a little bit about that flight up with the three widows?
Yeah.
It's really fascinating, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, when King was shot, Kennedy sort of went into action. And Kennedy gave his speech in Indianapolis. He had been advised not to because, as you all know, it was in a very dangerous, it was one of the worst ghettos in Indianapolis. The police chief told him not to go. The mayor of Indianapolis urged him not to go. The mayor, Richard Lugar, you know, later Senator Lugar, had never even been to this part of Indianapolis before. And everybody, and that was, again, one more reason for Bobby Kennedy to go, and he did. And then he went back to the hotel that night, and he instantly went into action and called up Coretta King to offer his condolences, and then to help plan for the funeral. And he said, these are all things that wouldn't have occurred to her, but she said, he said, you're going to need hotel rooms. We'll help book hotel rooms for you. You're going to need extra phone lines in your house. We'll get on that, and we'll arrange for the phone company to install extra lines in your house, because he knew the trouble he had had getting through that night to call to speak to her. And he said, and then he said, and is there a way that you're going to get the body back from Memphis to Atlanta? If not, we'll take, you know, we'll get a plane for you. I mean, this is the kind of thing one would have thought the President of the United States would do. But Robert Kennedy, as I said in the book, Robert Kennedy was in a way that night the de facto President of the United States already. And he was the one, as he said to her, I think he said something like, we Kennedys know something about assassinations and planning for the, you know, the consequences of assassinations. And Mrs. King was faulted for accepting help from a presidential candidate, and she said, listen, he's been through all this, he can help us, and I wasn't going to turn him down. It's just one of the striking stories about Robert Kennedy going into action and mobilizing and putting, you know, Robert Kennedys were very organized and going to work and making sure that the funeral would proceed in the way that it had to.
So how did the three, so it's Coretta Scott King, Ethel Kennedy, and Jacqueline
Kennedy. This is after Robert Kennedy was shot 2 months later in June, Coretta King flies out to Los Angeles to be with Ethel Kennedy. I mean, there are interesting stories, again, I mean, just to backtrack a little bit, and you'll bring me back if I forget where, you know, your question. Now I've lost that. After Martin Luther King was killed, Bobby Kennedy goes to the funeral in Atlanta. And I mentioned before that I interviewed Andrew Young. Andrew Young has given a lot of interviews over the years. You can imagine, I mean, he must, on any given day, he must have any number of reporters calling him, because he knows all the history of this era. I called, but, you know, he's somebody who knew these two men and therefore a very precious person to be able to have the great luxury to talk to. And he described for me, it's what I begin the book with, he described to me, leaving the hospital in Memphis where King had been declared dead, and convening a meeting to figure out where the civil rights movement was going to go. I mean, they had to get their act together and decide what to do that night. And where could they meet? Well, there was really no other place to meet but back at the Lorraine Motel. And they went into Martin Luther King's room, and that's where they met. And King's dirty dishes from his last meal were there. His suitcase was there. His clothes were there. They were surrounded by all the personal effects of a murder, of their murdered martyr leader. And he told this incredible, absolutely incredible story, which is not even in his own memoirs. This is another secret, really, to writing something like this. Even people who've been interviewed many times still have things to say that they haven't said before. And I thanked him, and I said, well, what a privilege it is to talk to you, and thank you for sharing all of this with me. And he said, well, no, thank you. He said, you know, I'm never going to get all these stories out. I couldn't fit them in my memoir, and I'm never going to get them out. And you did me a favor. And, you know, you've done me a favor by giving me a chance to tell this story. The other, John Lewis described the story about the Kennedys going, escorting Robert and Ethel Kennedy down to see King's coffin that night in the church, just by themselves, just the three or four of them together, going down to pay tribute to King as he lay there. This was the kind of bonding experience. The Kennedys were very visible down there, and Coretta King felt bound to them in a way that she hadn't before. And so after Robert Kennedy was shot, Coretta King goes to California to be with Ethel Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy leaves New York to be with Ethel Kennedy. And then they have to bring the body back. And this is the moment that you're described, that you mentioned, Miriam. There's this flight back. In this instance, the White House did send a plane, Air Force One. There were several Air Force Ones. Jackie Kennedy refused to board the plane until she was assured that it was not the same plane that had taken her back from Dallas. It was a different Air Force One. And you have this incredible moment when the three widows are all on this flight together. I mean, I get goosebumps even sort of thinking about it. And it had never really been described before. It's in my book, but only briefly. And I thought that as one of the stories that I did to sell the book, when the book came out, I did a very long story in the Washington Post about this last flight. The flight manifest is, if you see, this is one of Kennedy's advance men that saved the flight manifest and shared it with me. It's never appeared anywhere before. And it lists Pierre Salinger and all of the people in the entourage. And if you look at it, you'll see Jackie Kennedy is on there, Coretta King is on there, and obviously Ethel Kennedy. Ted Kennedy was sitting with the coffin at the beginning, Bobby's coffin in the front of the plane. And I, you know, there are most of the people, going back to the triage point, most of the people who were on that flight are dead. But there were a few who were still around. And I found the one surviving Secret Service man who actually saw the three widows talking to one another briefly. They were for everything that they shared, there was still a racial line between them, and Ethel Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy were not close. But there was one moment at the beginning of the flight where the three widows are together. But just the idea that these three women were on that flight together, you know, again, it's like the question that Bud asked earlier. I knew that no matter how difficult it was, to find particular information, there was a story in that flight. One way or another, there was a story. There were only three reporters on the flight. I mean, you can imagine how different it is from today when it would be swarming with people. But there were only three reporters on the flight, and they were all friends of the Kennedy family. None of them were working. And there was this sort of unwritten promise that they weren't going to talk about it. They were there as Bobby Kennedy's friends. Bobby Kennedy had many, many, many friends in the reporting corps, including Pete Hamill, and again, crossing lines in a way that would never happen now, you know, helping to write speeches for him and stuff like that, sort of shocking stuff. But anyway, I knew that there was a story in that flight, and the Post, you know, gave you this incredible space, and I think it's a It's just a very dramatic thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. I've had the pleasure through the years of interviewing more than a few people who were in Bobby Kennedy's orbit in 1967 and 68. Some were actually in the room in 68. Rafer Johnson, Rosie Grier, that famous audio we all know, get the gun, Rafer, get the gun. And talking to the two of them, and then others, like Keith Hamill, like Jack Newfield, who followed him in 67 and 68 in the campaign. And through the years, my experience has been talking to them, it's like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
And there was something about it that was just different, both in the positive, perhaps in the transformation of the man, and also being in the room. This is going back, say, 20 years, talking to Rafer Johnson and Rosie Grier. When I brought it up, they talked about it, they teared up, and it was as if the assassination had happened yesterday. Presuming that perhaps you had a similar experience with some people that you talked to, what do you think that's about?
Well, I envy you for talking to Rafer Johnson and Rosie Grier. I mean, I didn't really talk to... I never did reach Rafer Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
I should have thought of calling you, you know?
Did you know Bill Barry?
Well, I just mentioned Bill Barry. Bill Barry just died the other day.
Not that you.
Oh, were you? Well, I would have called you. You know, I would have called you for access to him. Bill Barry was the bodyguard, the security man, the former FBI guy who followed Bobby Kennedy everywhere. And he decided at a certain point to stop talking to reporters. He'd had enough, I guess. And I moved heaven and earth to try to talk to him. It was very hard to find his family because they used to be in Rockland County, but I don't know what happened to them. And he had oral histories. I mean, I mentioned before about the Kennedy families being very assiduous about recording their own history. He gave a very long oral history to the Kennedy Library, and he gave another oral history to Jean Stein, the mother of Katrina VandenHeuvel, who did a book on, I was going to say this before, there's a book about Robert Kennedy's final train ride from St. Patrick's, down to Washington, for his, to Arlington for the funeral, but never anything about that flight. Anyway, I needed...
Did you not write the article about Palm Beach when you went to the tour and Bill Barry took everybody away?
No, I didn't write that.
I just used byline.
No, I didn't write that, but I needed the family's permission to get to either of these oral histories where he presumably described his experiences with Robert Kennedy, and I could never get anybody. They never got back to me. Very frustrating.
And also recently the busboy died.
And the busboy died, too. For those of you who end up reading this book, there are various things. I don't know whether Robert Kennedy had an affair with Marilyn Monroe. I figured I was not going to break any news about that, so I didn't go down that hole. I don't know whether Sirhan Sirhan acted alone or not. So I didn't get in. These are just black holes that a reporter can go down and never, from which one never emerges. And I figured that I would have nothing distinctive or original to say about that. And so, I mean, I did find, in court papers, I did find, the garbage man that Sirhan got friendly with in Pasadena, the guy that picked up the garbage at the Sirhan Sirhan house, who was talking politics with Sirhan 2 months before the assassination and asked Sirhan, who are you going to vote for? Or Sirhan asked him who he was going to vote for. He said, I'm going to vote for Kennedy. And Sirhan supposedly said to him, you're not going to get the chance because I'm going to kill him. That was, I hadn't seen that story before. That was, again, something that was buried somewhere. But I didn't, I didn't go into the assassination, the conspiracy theories and stuff like that.
That's not the crux of the book.
That's right.
But what I did find interesting, though, which I had never, perhaps it was known, but I had never dawned on me that the assassination happens on the one-year anniversary of the Six-Day War.
No, right, and that part of the story has kind of been forgotten. That Sirhan, was upset over the sale of jets to Israel and all of that. Just to answer your other question, though, but it interests me how reporters conduct themselves. I just had an op-ed article in the Times that some of you may have seen about Little Rock and about the reporters who surrounded the black girl, Elizabeth Eckford, in the Little Rock Nine and kind of protected her against the mob after she walked the gauntlet in front of Little Rock Central High School. And it raises interesting questions about what reporters should and shouldn't do when they're covering a story and when they cross a line. And this is something that you see a lot in the Bobby Kennedy story, that reporters really fell in love with him.
Mm.
It's really striking. I mean, my own feeling, I was 16 when all of this stuff was happening, and I remember I didn't much like Robert Kennedy. I didn't like him because I thought that he was a pale imitation of his older brother, whom I loved, and who, you know, his death shakes me up to this day. And, I mean, sort of loved in kind of a juvenile sort of way. And I didn't like the way that he was sort of wrapping himself in President Kennedy, always talking about President Kennedy. Well, as President Kennedy used to say, you know, I found something macabre and sort of exploitative about it. I didn't like it. But the reporters who covered him lost almost all objectivity. And they fell in love with him, and they were devastated when he was killed. There's a story about Richard Harwood, the reporter from the Washington Post, whose son, John Harwood, you might see on television from time to time. He's a reporter on CNBC, a very good reporter. His father, Richard Harwood, was a tough old Marine and gave Kennedy a very hard time early in, when he was assigned to cover him, felt that Kennedy was making demagogic statements. And over the course of the campaign, he became very close to Kennedy, felt himself getting close to Kennedy, and within the last couple of days of the campaign, had resolved to take himself off the campaign because he was falling in love with Robert Kennedy. He felt he was losing his objectivity and had to get himself off the story. That's just unimaginable now with anybody. I mean, in this day and age, it's unfathomable that that could have happened.
Well, what's unimaginable is that he would pull himself off the story. It would be it's a different world, granted, apples and oranges, but imagine if, you know, Sean Hannity went on and said, I am too close to the president, I will give up my television show.
That
would be shocking.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. I hope you enjoyed our interview and nod to the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday and this first holiday of the American calendar for 2021, folks. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.